Tim Alberta says there was this pilgrimage to Trump Tower in the weeks after Donald Trump stunned everyone by winning the presidency in 2016. It was the world capital of kissing and making up, he wrote in a new article for The Atlantic. And Utah Senator Mike Lee had plenty of making up to do. Lee had been one of the leaders in a group of never-Trumpers who tried this scheme at the Republican National Convention to keep Trump from becoming the party's nominee. But in conversations with Alberta this past spring and summer, Senator Lee insisted that he did not go to Trump Tower just to bend the knee. He told a different story. Alberta says Lee reenacted this moment of machismo.
And of course, Senator Lee has been adamantly opposed to Donald Trump throughout the entire primary process, has really gone above and beyond in ways that no other Republican has to try to thwart him in his pursuit of the nomination.
I'm here today to announce my endorsement of Ted Cruz in his candidacy.
And then even in his pursuit of the presidency, calling on him a month before Election Day to drop out of the race.
Step down. Allow someone else to carry the banner of these principles that have made our country great, these principles that will stand as
and,
a beacon of...
You know, Lee tells me at the urging of some friends, he goes to Trump Tower, as many Republicans were doing at that point, with sort of their tail tucked between their legs, you know, begging for mercy and seeing if they could work their way into the good graces of the president-elect. But in Lee's telling, he went there still feeling defiant and even confrontational. And when the president-elect, in Lee's telling, began to sort of lecture him about all of the mean things he had said and how he hadn't been a team player, et cetera, Lee says that he sort of wagged a finger in Trump's face and put him on his heels and said, you know, let me be clear with you, sir. You just got elected. I've just been reelected, and I can either be, you know, your best friend or your worst nightmare, depending on your fidelity to the Constitution. And if you're not a defender of the Constitution, then I will be a real thorn in your side, and I will make your life miserable. The way that he's telling me this, he's sort of leaning forward in his chair and kind of hissing the words, and it was just very striking because, for one thing, anyone who's spent any time around Senator Lee knows that that's not really how he speaks generally. In fact, I couldn't find a single person who could recall him really ever speaking that way to anyone. But I think it's also just notable that Donald Trump had been really throwing his weight around in the Republican Party, insulting people, attacking people in really nasty ad hominem ways.
Lion Ted, what's your name? My name's Lion Ted Cruz.
Little Marco.
How would you spell that? L-Y-E-N. Lion.
Crooked Hillary. Crooked Hillary, Pop.
Jeb Bush is a low-energy person.
And, of course, most notably, had been going after Ted Cruz, Mike Lee's best friend.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald being, shot.
Suggesting that his father had helped to assassinate JFK, calling his wife ugly, and all of these things. And so Trump, up until this point, had really been this attack dog, this pit bull who was just, you know, chewing up and spitting out anybody who crossed his path. And so Lee, I think, wants to make it clear in his recollection of this pivotal meeting that he has with Trump that he was asserting his sort of primal male dominance, that he wanted Donald Trump to know who it was that he was dealing with. And I think that in many ways, Lee tells that story, or tells himself that story, to perhaps help justify some of the ways in which he has, ever since that meeting at Trump Tower back in late 2016, really sort of subjugated himself to Donald Trump and has become sort of the opposite of the alpha that he is describing himself to be in that anecdote.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Tim Alberta about his piece in The Atlantic magazine where he explores Mike Lee's about-face on Donald Trump. He says the story of this relationship is important because the senator will be a top candidate for attorney general if Trump wins this November. Alberta begins his piece with a contrast. He compares Mike Lee's role in the 2016 Republican National Convention, where he tried to sabotage Trump's presidential nomination, to this year's convention, where Lee declared that Utahns love the Constitution and despise tyranny. Alberta says the moment gave him deja vu.
It was really interesting because as I'm standing maybe, I don't know, 30 feet or so from Mike Lee in Milwaukee on the convention floor, as he is awaiting his turn in the roll call, where every state has, you know, deputized a speaker to announce that the state will be casting its votes for the presidential nominee of the party, in this case, Donald Trump. I was sort of watching him, wondering what he would say, what, you know, or if it would just be very sort of vanilla. Maybe he wouldn't say much at all, because 8 years earlier, rather famously, Senator Lee had made quite a scene on the floor of the convention in Cleveland when he was attempting to sort of, there's really no other way to describe it, but organize a coup to stop Donald Trump from being nominated as the Republican Party's nominee. Senator Lee was attempting to quite literally change the rules of the party to prevent Trump from becoming the Republican nominee, and it got very ugly, and he was ultimately defeated, but not before he threw a bit of a temper tantrum on the floor, and this was a scene that was captured by, you know, TV cameras all around the world. And so here he was 8 years later preparing to nominate Trump on behalf of his state. And so I sort of wondered what, if anything, he might say. And I have to say, I was shocked that he was so, not just so enthusiastic, but that he invoked tyranny and that he invoked the Constitution in the same ways that he had 8 years earlier invoked them to explain his opposition to Trump. He was now invoking them to explain his support, his enthusiastic support for Trump. And I feel like the split screen, the juxtaposition of those two convention floor moments is really almost a perfect window into the what's happened to the modern Republican Party.
Put the transformation of Mike Lee in perspective for us, if you would. I mean, the kind of neat and tidy way you do it in the piece is you say it's as if Ned Flanders became a 4chan troll.
Yeah. I mean, it is really difficult to put the personal, stylistic transformation of Mike Lee into words. You know, the substantive transformation is enough on its own. It's pretty jarring and has a lot of folks scratching their heads. But really, we see ideological and substantive evolutions in politics every day, and we become sort of desensitized to them. I think in the case of Lee, someone who was always viewed as kind of a choir boy, a guy who just went out of his way to be just unfailingly polite and kind and decent and thoughtful in ways that really made an impression on just about everyone in Washington. To see him now, you know, tweeting that the White House needs to provide a proof of life video because he's suggesting that actually Joe Biden is dead. And when he's trafficking on pretty much a daily basis in really crude conspiracy theories, and when he is, you know, allying himself with the likes of Charlie Kirk and Benny Johnson and Donald Trump Jr., and using language both online and in person occasionally, even, I've been told, that is just completely alien, not just to Lee, but to his social circles, to the LDS Church, to sort of his entire, the entire ecosystem politically, culturally, sociologically that produced Mike Lee bears no resemblance to the ecosystem that he now inhabits in person and online and with the friends that he's made in politics. And it really is, as I write in the story, two different people said to me in independent conversations that they worried that he was having a midlife crisis. Yeah.
And not the sort of midlife crisis necessarily where you buy a Corvette and run off with a younger woman, but something even more troubling in many ways.
You say for Mike Lee, this relationship with Donald Trump, it begins as this kind of transactional alliance that he says he lays out there at Trump Tower. And then he becomes this kind of reluctant Trump supporter. But you say it soon became personal for Lee. Is that does that help us understand what's going on here? Because it seems like it's quite a personal story that for Mike Lee. Does that seem right?
It does. I think the thing that has to be understood about Senator Lee is that when he came to Washington in 2010 after winning this upset in the Republican primary where the longtime incumbent, Bob Bennett, who was very popular, very well liked by the Republican leadership in Washington. When Mike Lee got there to replace him, he was really shunned. Yeah. He was not welcomed. He was not liked. He was not really, how to put this just plainly, he really didn't make many friends. And that's true not just among this sort of establishment types, but even among a lot of the sort of young gun conservative types. I think Lee sort of struggled to fit in. He didn't immediately have the outsized ambition that to run for president like some of his colleagues did. I think many of his colleagues he recognized at the time were paying a lot of lip service to the ideas of small government, Tea Party, constitutional conservatism, but really they were just kind of riding a wave in that political moment and didn't have deeply held convictions. And I think Lee sort of resented that. Yeah. So he kind of came to Washington as a little bit of a man without a country. And I think that he learned after a little while that that was really a lousy way to exist in our increasingly tribal political world. And I think that he sort of, first in latching on to Ted Cruz and becoming sort of the Robin to his Batman, and then ultimately with Donald Trump and now with the sort of MAGA subculture that surrounds Donald Trump, I think Lee had been searching for a sense of belonging, politically speaking. Mm. And I think that in a really sort of unexpected and ironic way, he is now found it just in the unlikeliest of places.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the setting for your conversations with Mike Lee. He often declines interviews with, some news organizations in Utah, including us. And I'm wondering, why do you think he agreed to talk to you? And why would he be interested in trying to make a case to you, do you think?
You know, it's a really good question. I can't read the man's mind. Yeah. But I will say that in my experience doing what I do, which is largely profile writing and feature writing for my magazine, what I often find is that if you sort of impress upon someone that you are making the rounds and creating this vast network of sources who know this person well and who are talking to you about this person, and make them aware of the fact that you are writing something that is sort of deep and comprehensive and that you're really digging into their life, it becomes very difficult often for that person to resist wanting to weigh in and wanting to give you their version of events wanting to control the narrative to the extent that they believe that they're able to do so. And so my sense is that probably played some role in it. I also think, if I can maybe peel back the curtain just a bit more, and maybe at the risk of giving away some of my trade secrets here, I think that in politics, everyone you come across feels misunderstood. And I certainly think that that's true in the case of Senator Lee. This is not someone who is totally lacking for self-awareness. I think he understands that many of his longtime friends, his longtime allies, people who have known him for decades and who have considered him a kindred spirit and people who really like the man are all sort of staring at him cockeyed, scratching their head, wondering what is going on. And so I think understanding the degree of disconnect that exists now in his world and among some of his friends and his allies, and I think that that probably factored into his decision to finally say, okay, you want to know what I'm thinking? Here's what I'm thinking.
One of the ways you describe the sort of condition of Mike Lee in this Trump era is all but unrecognizable. And this was something you heard from, you know, you say friends and allies and former staffers. Just one more way of sort of peeling back the curtain a little bit. Can you say a little bit more about the people you talked to, that Lee had been transformed by events or had adapted his position to sustain his ambitions? Did they talk about this as a moral failing or just – and it was also interesting that they – many of them anyway wouldn't – wanted to remain anonymous because they were worried he might retaliate. So the conversations you were having with different people, what was the sense? It seems like they were as baffled as you were about where he ended up. Maybe that's the way to put it.
Yeah, this was a difficult story to report in some ways, because I think there are a lot of these people who I'm talking with, former staffers, former colleagues, in a few cases, current colleagues, and then friends who, both from Utah and Washington, who sort of swim in the same waters, yeah, who feel a genuine affection for the man. You know, in other words, oftentimes it's easy to get people just to go dump on somebody who they can't stand and who they really dislike. But I think in the case of a lot of these people I'm talking with, they really genuinely are bewildered and almost hurt by what they've seen happen with Mike Lee. And so they were a bit tortured, I think, in many cases. You know, was this going to make it worse? Were they going to sort of deepen the divide? But I think at the same time, they just felt almost an obligation to talk with me and to try to think out loud about what's happened here and what's gone wrong. And is there kind of a way back? And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting to me is there were quite a few people who, you know, would only talk if I would protect their identities. But there were also quite a few who were willing to be quoted.
Yeah,
a couple of people who I was really interested in talking with were people who were friends and classmates of his at the BYU Law School,
right,
and they shed a lot of light on some of the sort of early formative decisions and challenges that he faced. That I think, for me anyway, really helped to open a greater window into the man and into his life and his personality. So it was a very challenging project, but also I think a very fulfilling one at the end of the day, because I do think, I hope that readers, after finishing the piece, will maybe have some answers to the questions that they have.
Tim Alberta, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article is called Why Mike Lee Folded. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Tim Alberta about this transformation of Utah Senator Mike Lee. Alberta has a piece in The Atlantic that works through Lee's evolution from his relentless attempt to keep Donald Trump from becoming the Republican nominee for president to being one of his biggest supporters. The article is called Why Mike Lee Folded. Let's talk about his father, Rex Lee. You describe him as a giant of the conservative legal movement. It seems as though just beyond his brilliance, the thing that stood out for you about Rex Lee was his independence and this deep sense of integrity about what he saw were the kind of broad interests of the nation. Talk about Rex Lee and who he is, and then we'll get to the sort of the influence on his son.
Of course. So Rex Lee is in many ways, almost next to his close friend Antonin Scalia, almost like a founding father of the conservative legal movement, and someone who is just revered by many of his contemporaries on the courts and many of the students he taught, the judges who in front of whom he argued cases. He served for a little over 4 years as Solicitor General to Ronald Reagan from 1981 through 1984. And really, Rex Lee compiled what is agreed to be one of the most, if not the most, impressive records arguing in front of the Supreme Court as any litigator that Washington had ever seen. We struggled in our fact-checking department to try to compare apples to apples, so ultimately we omitted a few of the statistics that we were working with. But based on a lot of the research we were doing, he may very well have compiled the most impressive litigation record in front of the court that of any solicitor general. So he was a brilliant, brilliant legal mind. So he is someone whose legal genius was sort of universally observed and respected. But to your point, the thing that really set apart Rex Lee, the thing that everyone talks about, everyone writes about, wherever you go for a remembrance of Rex Lee, you come across these really remarkable observations of his honesty, of his decency, and of his integrity, that word that you used. In fact, when he was eulogized after his very early death, he was just 61 years old when he succumbed to a long fight with cancer. And when he was eulogized, it was pretty notable that there was a Republican Supreme Court appointee and a Democrat Supreme Court appointee who both eulogized him at his funeral. And in fact, it was the Democratic appointee who eulogized Rex Lee and called him, quote, the epitome of integrity. And I think that description is consistent with everything you find about the man, that in fact, he spent much of his time as Solicitor General doing battle with the Reagan administration because he did not appreciate and did not find appropriate the political pressure that they were putting on him as Solicitor General, feeling like they were treating him as though he was some sort of political flunky rather than being the top litigator for the federal government. And he ultimately wound up quitting because of that political pressure. And he gave this famous quote where he said, "I'm the Solicitor General, not the pamphleteer general." And so there was this degree of intellectual and ideological and political independence that helped to carve out his reputation as something much more than just a sort of lion of the conservative legal movement.
How does Mike Lee talk about his father and about his sense of independence and integrity? Because he must bristle at the idea that maybe seems implied with that question that, you know, you're no Rex Lee, you're not like your father. What does he react that way?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's very clear that Senator Lee idolized his father and idolizes him still.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we would discuss him, the senator would speak sort of very wistfully about his father and about how his father had sort of set a bar that he himself will never clear. And I think there's a humanity there that was really striking to me, that this is someone in Mike Lee for whom the ghost of his father looms very large in his life. To lose him at a very young age and to, I think, wrestle often, as he told me he does, with how his father might be thinking about the sort of moment that we're living through now. And of course, to be wrestling with that against a backdrop of a lot of your one-time friends and allies sort of calling you out and criticizing you, saying that you have given in, that you are guilty of doing exactly the thing that your dad never did, which was sort of caving to political pressure and turning into this sort of tribal political machine player. And you know, I think that probably weighs on him a great deal. And it's hard to know what he's thinking in his private most moments, because I noticed on a few occasions he would sort of catch himself and kind of get his guard back up. But it was certainly apparent in our conversations that it does weigh on him.
You write that Senator Lee saw his father in the, as you say, in the realm of the powerful and profound, and that he found himself wanting to be a part of that. Did Senator Lee know what that meant when he was young, necessarily at first? Like, I want to be a part of this, but because it seems like this is what you write about. Because he could have gone in the same way that his brother went, and that is into constitutional law and becoming a judge. But he picked another. So talk a little bit about how he was thinking about, how he was influenced about what he was seeing in the powerful people that his father, you know, knew, and how that influenced what he became.
So let's go back in time here, because, you know, Mike Lee moves when he is a very young man. He's sort of just entering his adolescence, his preteen years. He moves to Washington, D.C., to the suburbs, I should say, of Washington, D.C., just outside of the district, in a very wealthy area where his neighbors and his classmates, everybody who he spends time around, they're all, you know, everyone is a congressman or a diplomat, yeah, or a K Street lobbyist, somebody powerful, and their kids are all raised in this milieu together. And so I think Senator Lee, from a young age, is observing all of this, and he sees the power and the prestige, the influence, and, you know, he talks with me a little bit about this, that he didn't know exactly what it was, but he knew he was pretty compelled by it, and he was pretty intrigued by it. And, you know, and then later on in life, I didn't even really have the time or space to get into this in the piece, but, you know, he winds up running for student body president, or the sort of equivalent position as an undergraduate at BYU.
Right.
And then you talk with folks who knew him in those undergraduate years, and then obviously when he's in law school, and the consistent answer you're getting from them is that they both knew he wanted to be in the mix, that he wanted to be a part of this world of sort of, you know, political intrigue, but that he didn't exactly know how to do it, or didn't know exactly where he was going to fit. And, you know, there's really this inflection point early in his law school career that I write about where,
yeah,
to the degree that a young Mike Lee wanted to try to follow in the footsteps of his father and then his older brother, Thomas, who's sort of regarded as a legal prodigy in his own right, that path was foreclosed upon relatively early when Mike Lee failed in his first attempt to qualify for the BYU Law Review.
Right.
And just for those who are not steeped in law school nuance, this was really a devastating blow, because effectively anyone who wants to earn really prestigious clerkships and go straight from law school to working in the federal court system in some capacity, you need to get on Law Review, and you really need to get on it and spend 2 years on it, the maximum of your second and third year. Well, going into his second year, he failed, and then going into his third year, he failed in the sense that he was not in the top 10% of his class.
Yeah.
He did wind up writing an essay that allowed him to write for the Law Review as a staff member. But in talking with a lot of people at the time, they all came back to the same conclusion. And again, many of these are people who like Mike Lee quite a lot. They said, you know, Mike was a good student, but not a great student. He was he was going to be a good lawyer, but never a great lawyer. He was not his dad. He was not his brother. And I think that he knew that seemed to be the overwhelming consensus, is that he himself, as a young man, kind of understood some of the limitations that existed there, and that sooner or later, he was going to have to try to strike out on his own, maybe doing something else, and that politics could be that off-ramp from the legal world.
So he He could have chosen the path of conservative scholar of the Constitution. Instead, his priorities shifted, you mentioned, so he becomes more interested in, as you say, partisan politics. Why do you think he chose politics?
You know, to spend time around the man is to see someone who is kind of a natural in many ways. And again, I write about this in the piece, even while on the one hand, he is turned into this sort of online MAGA troll caricature, he is simultaneously, when you spend time with him in person, very warm, very solicitous and generous with his time and can be very thoughtful. And so you can see how the skill set was always there. In fact, I remember talking with a couple of his colleagues from the Law Review who were in his class, and they said that he was a guy who just like always knew how to like shake a hand and kiss a baby, and just had these sort of natural political skills that many of them, as kind of law school nerds, didn't really have, and that he had this sort of this way about him, and this way to charm people, and really a way to kind of make people feel like he was their friend and their ally. Though if that sounds familiar, I mean, that's you know, kind of the mark of any really good retail politician, someone who can kind of walk into a room full of strangers and suddenly make them all feel like they're old chums. And so Lee has some of that. I think he also was sort of, I think he was, he became a little bit seduced by the platform that it would provide, because if you listen to some of the stories told about the years before he went into politics himself, running for Senate in 2010, he had worked for Governor John Huntsman as his general counsel, and he was sort of traveling the state and getting to know a lot of these Republican power players and sort of finding his way in partisan politics. And by all accounts, he really loved it and was really like enamored of it in a way that I think kind of tipped his hand early. A number of people told me that by the time he wound up running for Senate a couple of years later, that they were not at all surprised because they could sort of see that he'd been bitten by the political bug.
One of the people you spoke with was former Congresswoman Enid Mickelson. And she told you that she had, and this was around this time, before he becomes senator, of course, that she had started to develop these misgivings about Senator Lee, about Mike Lee. And this is how you put it in the piece. She remembers thinking something's off with this guy. What was she noticing? What was she telling you, do you think?
A couple of things. And I should note just for context that that Enid Mickelson was a student who remembers Rex Lee very fondly. She took his constitutional law class and told me that she idolized him. And so she was at first from a distance really excited about working alongside his son in Utah Republican politics. But she said as she started to sort of observe him and watch the things he was doing and saying, that she became really unnerved by him. And I think to hear her tell it, a lot of it was based in this perception that he was not authentic, that he was not really the sort of sincere, convicted, you know, thoughtful guy that he was trying to pass himself off as, but that actually he was kind of an opportunist and that he was a shapeshifter, so a politician who was kind of willing to do or say whatever he needed to in a given moment to win favor with the people who he was in front of. And she cited a few examples, one of them being his pledge during that 2010 campaign to get rid of birthright citizenship and actually change the Constitution of the United States, which was happening, of course, not in a vacuum. It was happening at the time when there was this crazed birther crusade on the right accusing Barack Obama of not having been born here. And so she describes him during that period as just sort of saying and doing things that didn't add up, that did not point to a picture of a really principled, serious person, but rather as this very ambitious young politician who was just kind of, at that point, seizing on any opportunity in front of him to gain power.
Tim Alberta, we're talking about his article, Why Mike Lee Folded. It's in the October edition of The Atlantic Magazine. We'll have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tim Alberta. We're talking about his latest piece in The Atlantic about Utah Senator Mike Lee. It's called Why Mike Lee Folded. I think it's 2009, you write about this time. This was after, of course, Barack Obama was elected, that Lee starts holding these pop-up constitutional seminars. Talk about what's going on with Mike Lee at this time, because you say he's sort of kind of this Tea Party prototype.
That's right, because during this moment, there's not yet a big visible footprint of the Tea Party that we would later come to see. I think at this point, Lee is kind of in the earliest days of discovering what this grassroots movement of kind of right-wing Republicans who are upset with both parties, feeling sort of disillusioned and disconnected from party elites in Washington, and they're beginning to really get agitated, and they're certainly very upset and angry about Barack Obama being elected, and Lee kind of has his finger on that pulse, and he is tapping into a lot of that grievance and that resentment in the conservative base. And he's doing these pop-up Constitution seminars, basically making these arguments around, you know, what federalism really is. And he's really doing it warning about Barack Obama wanting to be a king, wanting to be some sort of imperial dictator, that if we're not careful, that's the road we're heading down, because politicians in both parties are corrupt and cowardly and unwilling to really provide a robust check and balance on the federal government and on the executive branch especially. And so that's the intellectual and ideological case that Mike Lee is making. And you see around that time a lot of other ambitious young Republicans doing the same thing. Rand Paul in Kentucky and Marco Rubio in Florida. And then, of course, Ted Cruz a couple of years later in Texas. And this becomes really sort of the in vogue way for a young underdog Republican to defeat a more established, well-entrenched Republican incumbent. And it proves to be a hugely successful blueprint. But then, of course, when it comes to governing, all of these young Republicans, Lee included, recognize that they don't have any chance of delivering on the things that they had been promising.
It's interesting. This sort of brings us back to something we were talking about before, when he finally comes to – when he gets elected in 2010 and how he's treated by establishment Republicans at the time. And some of his friends and contemporaries said that they think that Mike Lee would have fallen in line and become a team player if he would have maybe been accepted by like Mitch McConnell and some of the other establishment Republicans. And then his former chief of staff, Spencer Stokes, told you that he thought if Mike Lee hadn't gotten caught up in the Tea Party movement in those early days, that he might have had a very different career. So it seems like in 2010, even though he comes in as this kind of insurgent, you know, conservative, that he could have just been a sort of more mainstream senator or player. Do you think that's right, if things hadn't gone in a different way?
You know, I'd go back to what I said earlier about this being a man who was sort of in search of his identity and in search of belonging. And in that context, yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense what Spencer Stokes and what others have said to me about that period, that that Lee saw in the Tea Party a tribe to rally around and to champion and he saw a brand to take to Washington with him. And I think in many ways, that's what made it so bewildering when Donald Trump came along, because Lee thought that this brand, this kind of purist, absolutist, small government, constitutional, conservative, Tea Party stuff that he and Ted Cruz and others had really used to batter the and knock down ultimately the gates of the Republican establishment. He thought that they were on their way to power, that they were sort of on the cusp of winning this civil war that had been raging in the GOP. And he thought that that's what the voters wanted. Hmm. And then along comes this guy who doesn't apparently really believe in anything and who is not at all consistent with much of the sort of small government conservative platform that he and others had been embracing and promoting. And yet this guy is beloved by the grassroots. He's beloved by the masses. And Lee, I think, not only is bewildered by it, but he really resents it. I think he develops this sort of this grudge towards Donald Trump, believing that this guy is now taken something that was rightfully belonging to him and to his friends.
So how does he turn, I guess, is the question. And it's, I think there's this story that you tell of where Mike Lee's sort of trying to make sense of how Donald Trump is catching on. And he has this conversation you write about with a member of his staff, trusted member of his staff. And the way the staffer talked about it was that politics was like this fight in a Wild West saloon. And this really worked with Mike Lee. It made sense to Mike. Would you just tell this part? Because I think Lee has this deep sense of awareness about Trump's tactics and why they might work. And this is really interesting.
So the story that Mike Lee tells is one where he's talking with a senior member of his staff, and they're just kind of sitting around shooting the breeze and trying to make sense of this hostile takeover that Trump is staging of the Republican Party. And that, yes, his staffer says, well, it's kind of like a bar fight that breaks out. And this one guy walks over to the bar and smashes the bottle and grabs the jagged edge and kind of, you know, waves it around. And everybody in the bar instinctively, intuitively wants to be on that guy's side, because all they know is that somebody's about to get hurt, and they want to be on the side of the guy who's got the bottle in his hand, right? And he said that was like a pretty good window into Trumpism and into, you know, why the party was sort of coalescing so quickly behind Trump. But of course, it's also revealing at a personal level in many ways, because the decisions that Lee has made himself to get behind this guy with the broken bottle who's threatening harm to so many people, it places him in a position of just extraordinary inconsistency, if I can put it sort of mildly, with the political persona and with the ideological positioning that was kind of central to his career preceding Donald Trump. And of course, that has manifested itself in all sorts of ways, but most notably with the fact that after Donald Trump lost a free and fair election in 2020, Mike Lee was sort of on the front lines, working behind the scenes with the White House, attempting to help Donald Trump stay in power illegitimately. And for a guy whose entire political rise had revolved around these warnings of an imperial presidency and dictatorship coming to America and the threat of tyranny because of a lack of checks and balances, and because of people putting sort of tribal affiliations ahead of the Constitution, the irony in all of that is just sort of profound and disturbing.
You do this really interesting thing in one of the conversations you have with Mike Lee. You show him this photograph of himself on the convention floor in 2016, where he's trying to sort of derail the Trump nomination, and he's screaming in the photo. How did he react when you showed him that picture?
It was interesting. He really tried to be nonchalant about it. he gave me kind of a grimace, but then sort of shrugged. And, yeah, well, yeah, you know, that was then, right? This is now. Because he's the smart guy. Yeah. He knew exactly what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a day goes by when someone doesn't raise the 2016 convention or make some kind of comment about his opposition to Trump. I mean, he's well aware of this dramatic about face that he has executed. And I think in some ways, maybe he's decided the best method for handling that is just to sort of shrug it off or kind of pretend that it didn't happen.
You mentioned in the story that Mike Lee could be a top candidate for attorney general if Donald Trump wins. And then you mentioned that you had asked him if he would accept that. What did he say? Because at first he didn't want to talk about it, at least not on the record.
He didn't. He asked me if we could talk off the record when I asked him the question. And I declined because I said this is too important. And so we then did wind up talking about it for a few different stretches. And I think some of what he said was to sort of downplay his interest in the role, that he loves being a senator, that this is the, you know, he's got the job that he wants, all the things that you will typically hear a politician say to sort of insulate themselves from accusations of openly campaigning for some other job that they don't yet have.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting when we started talking about the sort of peril that we are in as a nation because of the threat of a weaponized judicial system, and he believes that the DOJ has been weaponized against Donald Trump, and he talked about his argument for that. But then when I was sort of asking him about, okay, the what happens if Trump wins, and he leans on his attorney general the way that he leaned on Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions during his first term, you know, he sort of gave me conflicting answers. On the one hand, he said, you know, this door has been opened now and we have to close it. But then on the other hand, he talked about how actually you can't have the justice system completely depoliticized because ultimately the attorney general does answer to the president and the president does answer to the people. And so if you completely depoliticize the justice system from electoral politics, well, that's inviting its own set of problems. And I found that to be a very peculiar answer from the senator, because if in fact we are sort of approaching this crisis point as he believes we are, and as I think many of us believe that we are, and if in fact he is asked to serve as attorney general to a president who has shown really an open, explicit appetite for prosecuting his political opponents, for holding military tribunals, for, you know, bending the Constitution to his will at every turn. The idea that depoliticizing the Department of Justice is somehow something we should be worried about in that context is pretty bizarre. And I think gives a window perhaps into some of the kind of tortured logic that goes into being Senator Mike Lee at this very strange moment in his life and in our politics.
You point out in the piece the idea that nothing has changed about Mike Lee is the least satisfying and the most revealing. So what do you think happened? Did you come to any kind of conclusion? What happened to Mike Lee to make him turn?
The Republican Party has changed in really historic, significant ways. And I think in order to keep a seat at the table, Mike Lee recognized that he had to change with it. He saw what happened to friends of his, people like Jeff Flake in the Senate or Justin Amash in the House of Representatives. He saw that their continued opposition to Trump and their convictions cost them their careers. And I think in the case of Mike Lee, he values his career. He values this influence that he has. And I also think there's a part of him that just really was desperate to have an identity and a following and a brand that was all to his own. He saw a chance, perhaps, with the MAGA movement to kind of carve out his own niche. And he has. If you look at these alliances that he's built with Elon Musk and others, when you look at his social media following, when you look at
this sort of celebrity that he's created for himself on the far right. There's no question that he has kind of achieved this thing that he always wanted. The only question is, at what cost?
Tim Alberta, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tim Alberta, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article, Why Mike Lee Folded, appears in the October edition of the magazine. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.